From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, scientists in Boston have found a way to identify people with an increased genetic risk for a heart attack, but no warning signs. And remembering Richard Sipe, whose research helped uncover a pattern of sex abuse in the Catholic Church.
Something is breaking down. The old system of hiding it, of denying it, of covering it up, paying off, is breaking down. People are saying, we want honesty.
Plus, we check in on the long national grid worker lockout, now in its eighth week. Also today...
Do you support inclusion, diversity, and unity for the party and for the United States of America? If you support these things, you should support ranked choice voting. If you don't support these things, don't support ranked choice voting.
How automatic voter registration, ranked choice voting, and more could improve voting rights in the Commonwealth. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Hot off the research presses, there's a new approach that might just help prevent early heart attacks, breast cancer, or other serious diseases. But you don't get a diagnosis, just a probability score. Scientists at the Broad Institute, Massachusetts General Hospital, and Harvard Medical School have discovered a new way to calculate an individual's inherited genetic risks for heart disease, and they think it could be used to look at a variety of other risk factors as well. Joining us for our weekly Common Health check-in to talk about this research is Common Health contributor Karen Weintraub. Karen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
So, tell us, what's this research all about?
Well, this research dives into the fact that about one in five people who have a heart attack had no warning signs. We all know that high cholesterol can increase your risk of a heart attack, same with blood pressure, smoking, or family history of heart disease. But there's a whole segment of people who have none of these warning signs and still end up having a heart attack at a young age. Sek Katharasan, professor of medicine at Harvard Med, the Broad, and Mass General, and lead author of the study, told me that was really the starting point for his team.
What we've known over the last few years is that if you take 100 people with early heart attack, you can find the monogenic model in about two. That leaves a lot of people left with unexplained reason for why they had a heart attack at such a young age.
Okay, whoa, monogenic. That's one of those technical medical terms. But am I right to think that when he says monogenic, he means a mutation in a single gene, and this is something different, multiple genes, polygenic?
You got it. Mono means one, referring to the risks many people may be familiar with, like the mutation in the BRCA1 or 2 gene that dramatically raises the risk for breast and ovarian cancer. And they want to distinguish that from the polygenic model that they're working with, poly for many, because they're looking at the tiny, tiny contributions that many genes make towards someone's risk. The researchers look at more than 6 million spots in a person's genes to find changes that each might increase or lower your risk. They then calculate a risk score, so far for 5 common diseases: coronary artery disease, which triggers heart attacks, atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular heartbeat, type 2 diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, and breast cancer. They say, for instance, that about 8% of the population is at high risk for heart attack, but doesn't know it.
But maybe they will now, right? That's the idea. You're saying this technique could spot someone who's at an increased risk for heart attack, even if they don't have the traditional warning sign.
Exactly. And that's what Katharasan and his team are really excited about. Could potentially allow doctors to reach patients that are at an increased risk but are potentially unaware of that.
What's exciting here is that we have an entirely new genetic path to risk, this polygenic model that is identifying a set of people that heretofore have been kind of under the radar, have been unaware of their risk.
So, I mean, doctors, researchers, they get excited about polygenic models. patients want results, right? Do they actually think they can prevent heart attack?
Right, they do, actually. So that once you have your polygenic risk score, if you're at high risk, you could change your lifestyle a little bit, take a statin, and perhaps lower your risk.
Well, it turns out over the last couple of years, we've shown that the DNA is not destiny here, that risk conferred by the polygenic score can be modified, that basically being optimal on lifestyle can cut that risk in half, And statin medications that lower cholesterol can cut the risk in half as well.
So, okay. People want this information. It's useful, not just for researchers. Can we get it? How hard is it to get this polygenic risk score?
You can't necessarily get it right now, but soon. If you've already had like a 23andMe or Ancestry.com type of genetic test, you have all the information you need to get this analysis. And 17 million Americans have already done this, have gotten these genetic tests. And they usually cost, I don't know, about $100, maybe a little less. The researchers are setting up a web service that will allow you to upload your 23andMe information and get back your risk score to figure out if you're in one of these high-risk categories. And they're going to start with heart attacks. Because it's a research project, Kath Reason says it won't cost you anything to get this score. And he thinks it's going to be ubiquitous everywhere. Everybody's going to get one of these at some point.
And so I actually think in a few years, most people will have the opportunity to know this number, this polygenic risk number, similar to the way we know our cholesterol right now.
Now, presumably one reason we're focusing on heart attacks is that it's still the number one leading cause of death. But there's nothing special about heart attacks in this regard. Presumably we could use the same technique to identify increased risks for lots of other diseases.
Right. They're starting with heart attacks because there's a clear benefit. You can do something about it. But in theory, Kath Reason says it's possible to establish a risk score for any disease that has a significant amount of genetic research done on it. They're working on other risk scores now for Alzheimer's, obesity, prostate cancer, and colorectal cancer. But aside from heart attack, they may not make the others publicly available right away because researchers need to test first whether it helps people know their risk, if it helps to know your risk score, if it isn't, if there aren't things like statins that you can take to bring down your risk.
You don't want to make people too nervous, tell them they're at high risk of some disease for which there is no treatment.
Exactly. Some people want to be informed of everything. Others will live their lives in constant fear unless they're below average risk for everything.
That me.
So I asked Dr. Robert Yeh, a cardiologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, who wasn't involved in this study, whether he'd want to look at his own risk scores. He says yes to the heart attack risk, but like all good researchers, he wants to know more. He wants to make sure for other conditions where doctors don't just hand out statins, if having this kind of information changes how patients are cared for and how they fare.
Short of that evidence, I'm not sure that I'm ready today to say that, you know, I want this test done on me. I'd like to see more evidence and more research done, which I'm sure these authors are interested in doing as well.
It's interesting that he's so trepidatious, but that hesitation, it doesn't extend to cardiology, just the other conditions.
Right, because there isn't a pill you can pop to treat atrial fibrillation or prevent diabetes. But as a cardiologist, he thinks doctors like himself will provide the scores to patients and then offer statins and lifestyle changes to those at high risk for heart attack. Fundamentally, Yeh says having a risk score will help avoid those unpleasant and dangerous medical surprises.
People represent a constellation of genes, of environment, and the greater ability that we have to integrate more information pieces to identify patients at elevated risk, I think the more successful we're going to be in actually ultimately preventing and treating diseases before they occur.
So lots more research to be done, but this is a very promising place to start.
Promising is good. That's Karen Weintraub illuminating all of us about the possibilities of detecting diseases we didn't know we were at risk of. She's a contributor for WBUR's Common Health. Karen, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
A strike is when workers walk off the job. But a lockout? That's when the company stops workers from clocking in. For the last 7 weeks, National Grid has locked out 1,200 union workers following a breakdown in contract negotiations. The stakes? Healthcare and pensions. The endgame? As yet unclear. And as the lockout has dragged on, the dispute has turned personal among people who have worked side by side for decades. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman brings us this report.
For the president of one of the world's largest investor-owned utilities, Marcy Reed's office in National Grid's headquarters in Waltham is surprisingly small and bare. She's all business.
I didn't come here to work 30 years. I came figuring I'd work two or three. And 30 years later, I'm sitting here in front of you, having loved almost every minute of it.
The low point in Reed's career with National Grid came at midnight Sunday, June 25th. That's when contract negotiations, which had gone on for months between the utility and two United Steelworker locals, came to a grinding halt.
And I was on the phone about every hour, midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. When we ultimately decided at 5 a.m. they weren't going to agree to our final package, at that point, we made the decision to inform them that we would be locking them out.
By dawn, the gates at National Grid's facilities that serve 700,000 gas customers in 85 communities in eastern Massachusetts were locked shut. In Malden, passing cars honked support as members of the Steelworkers Local protested in front of the utility's operational yard. Some have worked here for nearly 40 years. Diane Toll has 24 with the company. She carried a sign, proud to be union.
The union wanted to continue to bargain, but National Grid locked us out. And National Grid will hopefully go back to the table and work with us. Till then, we're out of work. Out of work.
The utility says it's willing to bargain daily, the union once a week, until the company changes its final offer. But Marcy Reed says no contract, no work, though locking out 1,200 people hasn't been easy.
All of a sudden, employees with whom you're friends and colleagues are not coming to work the next day, which means they're not getting a paycheck, they're not getting their health care, and all of a sudden I need to find a different way to do the work. So it was a tough decision. But it was a decision we make, and actually I would make it all over again.
That decision was a long time in the making. In 2016, negotiations over a five-year contract stalled, so the unions and utility settled to leave things as they were for 2 years. But the positions and passions that divided then are even deeper now.
Well, I wouldn't say we were exactly family to begin with. When you talk about the relationship, it hasn't been an easy one.
John Bonapane, president of United Steelworkers Local 12012, stands with members of his union picketing in front of the National Grid facility in Waltham. Bonapane says gas workers would settle for an extension of their old contract. He blames National Grid.
They're looking at trying to squeeze some concessions out of 1,200 workers, but they deserve those benefits. And this company makes $1 billion, so we're willing to work with them on the health insurance. We've told them that, and they understand that. They just haven't moved from their original position. They've really dug in.
Bonapane accuses the company of trying to undermine the union by requiring workers to pay more for their health insurance and divide members by forcing new employees into 401ks instead of company-funded pensions current workers get.
Who's to say next contract they're not going to come back to us and say, you know what, I know it was just the new hires this time, but this time we want it back for everybody.
But Marcy Reed says the company is just offering the same benefit package it's negotiated with 16 other unions.
The cost of health care and pensions have just gotten to a point where we can't be passing that level of cost on to our customers.
The utility is asking for a 13 to 17% rate hike next year. According to National Grid, the average salary for skilled, locked-out workers in the field is about $140,000 plus benefits. The company offered to increase pension contributions 10% and wages 14%, but during negotiations, it was also planning for a lockout, just in case.
We wanted it to be, you know, the best plan we never used, is what we called it. We knew we needed to keep the work going. We serve a product that's 24/7. Our customers aren't going to wait for us.
To keep the gas flowing and respond to emergencies, the company redeployed 700 contract workers and put 600 supervisors into the field to replace the locked-out union workers, who have been showing up at job sites, recording what they allege are safety violations by their replacements.
July 19th, April, he's putting the fire suit on in the hole. He's already in the hole putting the fire suit on.
The unions have sent state regulators this and dozens of other videos from job sites, they say show safety violations by substitute workers. Meanwhile, at the trenches, temperatures soar, and at times, tempers flare.
Yep, somebody put it in wrong.
Whoa!
Can't do your job right!
Marcy Reed calls the confrontations at work sites unfortunate. She says security is provided for substitute contract workers and managers, and if any safety concerns are observed, prompt action is taken.
Every person who's doing the real work on the gas mains has their state and federal certifications. Why, in heaven's name, would I put anyone on a job site that's not safe? What do I have to gain from that?
The lockout has taken a toll on both sides. National Grid managers have lost their summer vacations and union workers their livelihoods. Joe Carrillo is president of the other locked-out union local.
Some people are never going to get over this, and you can understand why. When you have ill children and they cut your health care off, it's something that you're not going to forget.
We know there's just going to be all kinds of hard feelings, scar tissue that has to be resolved.
Robert McCursey is professor emeritus of industrial relations at MIT's Sloan School.
The fact that it was a lockout, it's a very aggressive action. It's a very harsh negotiating tactic by an employer. And how are they going to, in a sense, mend fences and deal with all of the hard feelings when the family gets back together?
McCursey says the toughest and most important relationships to repair are between union workers in the field and their managers, who have replaced them since the lockout began. National Grid President Marcy Reed knows the gas utility has its work cut out for it.
People have feelings. It'll be tough to get past it. And I'd be naive if I thought that all of those feelings are going to go away overnight. But working at National Grid, it's kind of like a family. And so it's in that spirit that we're going to bring them back.
The last time union gas workers in Massachusetts were locked out was a quarter of a century ago. That one lasted 17 weeks. Today, National Grid's lockout begins week 8.
That story from WBUR's Bruce Gellerman. Stay with us. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz.
Something is breaking down. The old system of hiding it, of denying it, of covering it up, paying off, is breaking down. People are saying, we want honesty.
That's A.W. Richard Sipe speaking on CNN back in 2002 about the sex abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. Sipe died last week in California at the age of 85. You may not immediately recognize his name, but Sipe was a key figure in modern Boston history, an indispensable aide to the Boston Globe team that exposed a pattern of sex abuse, cover-up, and secrecy within the Catholic Church back in 2002. Sipe himself was a psychotherapist, a former Benedictine priest, and a fierce advocate, even when no one would listen. Joining me now is one of the members of that Pulitzer Prize-winning Globe Spotlight team who benefited from Sipe's research and friendship, Michael Resendiz. Hello, Michael.
Hey, hello. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. I'm interested both in some perspective on Sipe and on that era where he was so helpful. How did you get to know him?
Well, I got to know him when Phil Saviano dropped by the Globe Spotlight office. Phil is a survivor of clergy sexual abuse. And if you've seen the Spotlight movie, you can see a very accurate scene where he drops by with a lot of evidence of more abuse.
And in like a cardboard box.
Yeah, he had a cardboard box. It's literally true. A cardboard box filled with books and documents. And in that box was a CD. And on the CD were a bunch of documents. And I went through the CD. And in it, there was Richard Sipe's expert testimony in the criminal trial of a priest in Dallas, Texas, who was convicted of sex crimes. And I read this document, and I just knew this was the guy. His explanation of clergy sexual abuse was so deep and so profound that I immediately tried to call him.
And that call turned out to be quite helpful. He was instrumental in what? In how you thought about it and getting data? And how was he helpful?
He was helpful in so many ways. He knew there was a pattern. He knew that this ran very, very deeply within the Catholic Church all over the world. You know, when we started doing our reporting, we literally couldn't believe what we were finding. There were so many victims. There were so many bad priests. How could this be possible? Richard told us how it was possible.
And how was it possible? I mean, the numbers in some way, they don't cease to be startling just because we know them to be true.
No, now this scandal is erupting in countries all over the world, and we can see that this is truly systemic. We can see that what happened in Boston was nothing unusual. There's nothing funny in the water in the city of Boston. This is a systemic problem in the Catholic Church all over the world. Richard believes it all comes from the culture of celibacy, not celibacy itself, but the culture of celibacy. And essentially, what Richard points out is that all priests are prohibited from having any sex at all, which is a very unnatural condition to live in. And some priests are having sex with women, and some are having sex with men, and a smaller cohort is having sex with children. What Richard points out is since they're all transgressing, they all have an interest in protecting one another, especially when their superiors are having sex of one variety or another.
So what undergirds the culture of abuse is a kind of culture of protection, where there are priests protecting one another from all kinds of transgressions against celibacy.
In short, it is a secret society running a protection racket.
Just to get a sense for Sipes' involvement, maybe it's worth playing a clip from the movie, the 2015 movie Spotlight, which chronicled the Globe's reporting in the on that story. In the movie, you're played by Mark Ruffalo.
Yes.
And we hear in this scene Richard Sipes on speakerphone breaking down his findings to the Spotlight team.
My estimate suggests 6% act out sexually with minors.
6% of what?
6% of all priests.
How many priests do we have in Boston?
About 1,500. 1% is 15. 6% is 90.
Wait. 90 priests.
Is that possible?
From a metric standpoint, yes. That would certainly be in line with my findings.
I mean, in that scene, and throughout the movie in general, part of the role he plays is to make you believe that it's possible, that you're not on some kind of witch hunt where you're seeing abuse everywhere because you're looking for it. But in fact, that if you're unearthing dozens of cases, it's because mathematically there are probably dozens of cases.
Exactly. I mean, we were just so stunned at what we were discovering. I mean, we started our investigation with one priest, one. And when we realized there might be half a dozen, we were just astounded. And here's Richard Sipes saying, well, actually, it might be 90. And I have to point out that today, just in the Boston Archdiocese, the number is 250.
Wow.
And that works out to a little more than 10%, not 6%. So Richard, who was vilified at the time he released his findings and his research, the man who was vilified was actually making a conservative estimate.
And when you're talking to him, this is 2002, he'd been saying this, or 2001, he'd been saying this for over a decade, right? He'd been saying it in the 80s. He published a book in 1990. He'd been screaming this into the void for some time.
That's absolutely correct. Screaming it into the void is a good way to put it. I mean, he went everywhere. He was an expert witness in trial after trial, in civil suit after civil suit, and never really gained any traction, I think in part because of the really profound cover-up of clergy sexual abuse, and also because people just couldn't believe it.
It's interesting that he could be an expert witness, that the legal system took him seriously in a way before the public did. You know, even as journalists, you know, you guys had trouble taking it seriously. Was it the influence of the church? I mean, what factors prevented people from taking this threat seriously or his warnings seriously?
You have to understand that not very long ago, 15 years ago, certainly 30 or 40 years ago, virtually every part of society was involved in this cover-up. You know, if a priest got caught abusing a child and it was reported to the police, there was never an arrest. There was never an arraignment. There was never a trial. Everything got hushed up. I've heard from reporters all over the country who had stories about priests abusing children who either didn't follow up because it was too incredible or who were discouraged by their editors. I mean, this happened everywhere. So the press, the judiciary, the law enforcement, all of these arms of our society were part of the cover-up. And as Richard said in your opening segment, this is what has started to break down.
You kept in touch with him afterwards over the years, at least a little bit. Did he feel that it had broken down, that progress was being made, that he was making a difference, had made a difference?
Yes. I mean, I kept in close touch with Richard, and he did believe that progress was being made in a sense that the system of cover-up was disintegrating, that people were no longer willing to cover up for priests who abuse children. On the other hand, I think he remained quite pessimistic about the ability of the Catholic Church to seriously do anything about this in a systemic way.
I think it's just worth saying, because I don't know that we did, that Richard himself was a Catholic. He had started life, he was an ordained priest. He had been a monk. So, I mean, he knew this system from the inside. I mean, there's a great line from Joyce that, you know, some people are injected with the Jesuit strain just in the wrong way. There's that sense like he knew this from the inside, and that's what made him want to reform the church so desperately. Is that your sense for his motivation?
Yes. I mean, Richard is someone who really loved the church. And I think in his heart, he always did. Even though he was so disillusioned by the Catholic Church and so discouraged by the hierarchy, I think that there was a place in his heart that always deeply loved the Church. And it gave him incredible insight and incredible sorrow.
Did he see this happening elsewhere? I mean, this concern about child sexual abuse is not limited to the Church. Do the same kind of principles that he applied to thinking about how to track it in the Church apply to other areas? Did he think about schools or elsewhere?
Well, yes, he did. And, of course, I think wherever you have power relationships and people in authority who are not accountable, you're going to find child sexual abuse. Richard believed, and I agree with him, that this problem is more serious in the Catholic Church because of the culture of celibacy. And if you look at the numbers, you know, they're pretty horrific. I mean, in Boston, it's 10%. But in the handful of dioceses where we have all the records, the percentage is more than Richard's initial estimate of 6%. But the percentage always approaches about 10%.
I mean, you have a unique perspective, not just on Richard, but on this whole problem of sexual abuse in the Church. And I wonder what you're feeling about it in the current climate is. Do you think this is mostly a solved problem, mostly a buried problem? Where does it stand?
No, this is not a solved problem at all. Scandals about clergy sexual abuse continue to erupt all over the world. I mean, we're now in a situation where there have been allegations that Cardinal McCarrick, who's the Washington, D.C. cardinal, abused seminarians in New Jersey. We have the third highest ranking official in the Vatican, Cardinal George Pell, on trial in Australia. This will not stop. It will not stop. And I guess what's amazing is that the Vatican still hasn't really done anything about it. And this has been going on so long that I now question whether the Vatican is able to do anything about it. And I think Richard had that same question.
Are there things you want people, just to switch back from the institutional to the personal, to know about Richard, about his life?
Well, Richard was a very surprisingly gentle man and a deeply compassionate man. And he traveled all over the country as an expert witness. And everywhere he went, he got to know victims of clergy sexual abuse. And somehow, they all remained his friends. They've all stayed in touch with him. The lawyers have all stayed in touch with him. The therapists have all stayed in touch with him. There's something about him that's very warm and very embracing. Despite all the horrors that he has discovered, he remained a very gentle, compassionate person with kind of a gift for friendship.
Well, you penned a remarkable sort of remembrance of him in the Globe, and you closed with a couplet from a poem that he'd written, and I gather you brought that poem with you. Hopefully you'll read it.
I did, and I would love to read it. You know, at the end of his life, Richard wrote quite a bit of poetry. And he wrote two collections, and he wrote about death quite a bit, not surprisingly. And this is a poem called At My Graveside. Tell no lies as you give me to my grave. Fear not my imperfections. They were cause for good. My peace with the universe embraces light and darkness. Scars speak of battles won and lost. My faults served some others well, all worth the cost. Truth alone will honor what I've been or done.
It's a remarkable poem to read after his death. Thank you. Well, that's Michael Resendiz. He's a Boston Globe correspondent and a former member of the Globe Spotlight team that exposed the Catholic Church's cover-up of clergy sex abuse. That reporting won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize. Thanks, Michael.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Election season is heating up, and some cities and states are trying to improve the process. Governor Baker signed a bill last week adopting automatic voter registration here in Massachusetts, meaning eligible residents are simultaneously registered to vote when they get their driver's licenses or health insurance through the state. Or look north to Maine, which became the first in the nation to adopt ranked choice voting for its statewide elections, allowing voters to rank candidates from first to last when completing their ballots instead of just voting for one person. Listeners in Cambridge know what I'm talking about. But maybe it's time to go even further, completely reimagine how we vote in Massachusetts. Joining me to talk about that possibility is Aaron O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston. Hello, Aaron.
Good to hear your voice.
Also joining me from the studios of New England Public Radio is Gerald Duquette, Associate Professor of Political Science at Central Connecticut State University. Hi, Gerald.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm doing great. And I hope our listeners are doing great because we're going to ask them to join us in this conversation. If you could redesign voting in Massachusetts, how would you do it? Think big. You think automatic voter registration is going to work? Want to see ranked choice voting? Something else? Something you've always fantasized would make voting better? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've always wanted to say that. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So let's start with the smaller stuff. Aaron, automatic voter registration. This is now going to happen in Massachusetts. Is it going to make a difference?
Yes. Massachusetts is, we are hanging with states that you don't want to hang with when it comes to ease of casting a legal ballot. And what the governor signed, and obviously both chambers passed, and passed by overwhelming number with automatic voter registration, the most estimates that we could see several hundred thousand more individuals in the Commonwealth registered to vote. And as a political scientist, I think that is a fabulous thing. So Massachusetts has really moved from back of the pack to, you know, becoming more of a leader.
Gerald, you agree this is a good thing, going to help the right people, going to increase turnout?
Well, it's a good thing, and it will increase the opportunity to vote for sure.
All right. Well, let's hear Secretary of State William Galvin said about it. He was talking about how he and other advocates of the bill want to begin implementing this pretty soon, so it's in place by the time of the presidential election.
We're shooting for 2020, to have this in place for 2020, recognizing the significance of that upcoming presidential election. That will give us the opportunity to begin working in 2019 to make sure this bill reaps the fruit of the effort.
Gerald, how does automatic registration compare to something else you hear a lot about, which is same-day registration? Similar kind of impact, totally different?
Well, they're designed to have a similar kind of impact. The point is to allow folks who only become aware of an election very late in the process to be able to vote, right? So if you aren't paying attention because the election is right after you get back from your summer vacation, if it's automatic voter registration, you're already registered. If it is same day, you can show up at that September 4th primary, having only realized there was an election a week ago.
You don't know till the last minute. I should say again to listeners, call us. Tell us how you would fix voting, get more people to vote or less people to vote or make it easier. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. So another possibility then. Let's go from the, hey, we already did it to the, hey, they did it in Maine issue. Aaron, ranked choice voting. Can you start by explaining how that works?
Sure, it's actually pretty easy. Say there's, like in the Suffolk County DA race, what, there's five or six individuals running. What you do is you rank one through five, your choices for candidates. And if the winner gets 50% on the first count, then she or he wins. But if no one reaches 50%, they go to whoever came in last and redistribute those votes. So the first choice votes that went to the candidate with the least amount of support will get redistributed to those voters' second choice. So what it does is the zero-sum game of voting. Like if you were a Bernie supporter, but you didn't want to vote for Hillary, you could put Bernie first, Hillary second, and Trump third. And so even though you might not have gotten what you wanted with ranked choice voting, you're at least going to get your second choice. So it's a better barometer of voters' interest, their true preferences. And a lot of voters go in now and hold their nose when they pick between a Republican and Democrat. With ranked choice voting, they can put who they truly want first and then second, third, and fourth. So we find that voters tend to have they voice a better experience with voting when ranked choice is there.
So, and Gerald, Do you get the sense that voters understand that process, could be taught, could be educated to understand the process and how they think about how many people they vote for and how they rank them?
Well, if we can get Aaron O'Brien on the radio more often, then there'd be no problem. Yes, I don't think that voters have a difficult time understanding how to do it. I want to point out, though, that we were just talking about automatic voter registration. That's really about making voting easier. Ranked choice voting is about making it more precise or more accurate, a more accurate reflection of the voter's actual intentions or interests. So there's a slightly more sophisticated purpose behind ranked choice voting. Which so, I bring that up only because in Massachusetts, the thing that we were able to do was sort of one of the lower level make voting easier things, automatic voter registration. Ranked choice voting would be a much more challenging reform to get passed in Massachusetts.
And so you're saying it actually has a different purpose, too. Now, we could, in theory, am I right about this, use ranked choice voting to do away with districts and do statewide ranked choice voting, say, for the House of Representatives? I'll ask Aaron this.
I mean, it could be done.
Because then you do away with sort of gerrymandering, other problems like that.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I think that's harder to do in the sense like, you know, like for, are you going to rank your top 40 state Senate picks? You know, I mean, like, I can't name all 40 and it's my job to know that. So I think it is possible, but it makes a lot more sense at the town, city, locality level than trying to do it statewide when you need to fill a chamber, a state Senate, or a state legislature.
All right, well, let's go to a listener because we've got somebody with a big idea. It's Miguel from the Mass Pike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Basically,
no, it's great to have
you. I think voting should be mandatory. I think democracy is something as Americans that we cherish, and voting should be part of our duty. In this way, it would avoid just the extreme showing up at the ballot.
So everybody must vote or else what?
Well, other countries, like, for example, Brazil imposed a fine. If you don't show up to vote, there's a fine. Or there is, I think we could think of ideas that are related to when you're getting your driver's license or so on that have to do when you have to renew documentation that you should be at least registered to vote and show up to vote.
That's great. Gerald, what do you think of mandatory voting?
Well, I mean, it's very tempting, right? And especially for those of us who are trying to understand what the people, you know, want, and that having them, you know, requiring them to show up could be useful from our perspective. But obviously, it's a difficult thing in a country where we think of ourselves as having all these rights to do what we want to do, to say you have to do this. But you could do it in a promotional way. I mean, you could have mandatory voting that you are rewarded for rather than punished for not doing, right? A tax break or something of that nature could be
a day off from work.
Right.
Or day off from work.
I say to my students all the time, we have to pay taxes. I don't have to register to pay my taxes. Right. So it's not, you know, we mandate things quite regularly. It feels a little weird to say you have to vote. But as the caller said, many countries do this. They also provide a day off from work for it. And so it's not as outlandish when we really start to think of how many things government actually mandates that we do.
So, Aaron, do we know if it works? Other countries do it. Do they get 100% turnout?
They don't get 100% turnout, but it depends on the country, obviously. But it's usually between 80 and upwards of 90%. So it's quite reflective of the population.
But 80 or 90%, yeah, that would be a huge increase on turnout in a lot of U.S. elections.
It would be amazing. I mean, we make it really hard to vote in the United States, which there's a lot of ironies in that.
Right.
All right. Let's go to another call. This is Christine from Malden. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So one of my issues is the accessibility, particularly for people who work 40 hours a week and are paid by the hour. Why are we only voting on one day a week? Why aren't we voting on 3 days? Why aren't we voting on a Saturday and a Sunday and a Monday so that people can work out their religious issues, their work issues, their family issues, and still be able to vote?
Great. So you have a couple of, I mean, we vote on this Tuesday in the middle of the week, and you're saying it could be a couple of days, could be a weekend. Mm-hmm. Gerald, you changing the date?
Well, there's two ways to look at that. We can sort of just look at it in a functional way. Hey, wouldn't it be more efficient? Wouldn't it be better? Wouldn't more people have an opportunity to vote if we expanded the time you can vote? Or we can sort of look at it in terms of power politics, right? Why do we only vote on one day, a Tuesday? Why is it so inconvenient? Well, obviously, the people who are winning in the current system have no incentive to change the status quo. So in some respect, whenever you run up against election laws that seem somewhat less than optimal, you have to admit that maintaining the status quo is pretty important for those for whom the system works currently.
So, I mean, that brings up a good point, because these are not just theoretical considerations, right? These are political right. considerations. There is some group of people, some constituency who might favor change and some constituency who favors the status quo. Aaron, is there a constituency for better access to the polls?
Well, a lot of good government groups, you know, Common Cause, League of Women Voters, and anybody who's ever held their nose when they had to vote in election. Like, I think for many voters, not all, choosing between Trump and Hillary Clinton wasn't their dream date candidates. So I think anybody who's been dissatisfied with the lack of ways for third party candidates to win are folks that favor change. And I actually think, you know, automatic voter registration getting passed, we were talking about, that is a really big deal, because now elected officers or elected officials in Massachusetts, their constituency just changed pretty dramatically. So it is a big deal that it got through the House and the Senate and Baker signed, because I've had many politicians to say to me off the record, they don't want to make it easier to vote because they're winning in the existing right. system. And so right. As much as people hate each other politically.
People say that to
now,
you direct, openly, avowedly?
I was on a panel and the guy right next to me, I mean, he was honest. He was evil, but honest.
Let me just say for listeners who still want to join us, the number is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. With your suggestions, reasonable or crazy, we take them all for how to improve voting in Massachusetts.
Evan, one of the tricky things about whether there's a constituency for reform is when you are reforming processes, that's a somewhat inside baseball endeavor. And the average voter doesn't really pay much attention to process. So there's definitely a constituency. The question is there a sufficiently potent constituency? Is there a constituency that can actually turn around and energize enough voters so that you have to listen to that constituency? In other words, because it's a process issue and not sort of a direct interest of the voter issue, it's harder to break through.
And in Maine, right, the reason that constituency came together for ranked choice voting was because a lot of voters were unsatisfied with the results of, with the election of a governor who wasn't enjoying majority support, correct?
Right. That's exactly
yeah, so
right.
So that outcome makes a big difference. Let me throw out another one. Vote by mail. Is there good evidence about vote by mail?
We differentiate between convenience voting things. That's a convenience voting measure. It makes it easier for people to vote. And what we find with most of those measures, things like, you know, voting on weekends, early voting, convenience voting measures do increase turnout. More people vote as a result. But the socioeconomic bias between voters and non-voters remains with convenience voting. When you do measures that change registration, meaning everyone's registered automatic voter registration, or you eliminate some of the registration barriers, you do same-day registration, those things both increase turnout and lessen, never end, but lessen socioeconomic bias in turnout between higher income and lower income. So those two sets of reforms have differential effects. They always affect turnout up, but they don't always cut into class bias.
Interesting. Let's take another call, this time Maxwell from Franklin. How you doing, Max? Well, I shouldn't assume. How you doing, Maxwell?
Good. So my question is, you know, right now we have a representative democracy where every representative has one vote. What if we had a delegative democracy where we can delegate our vote to a representative so all the representatives have different votes based on how many people they represent?
Interesting. Gerald, what do you think?
I'm just trying to figure out exactly what that means. So if I represent, 100,000 people, I have to figure out what the majority of them wanted and vote that way? Is that what he's suggesting?
Oh, Maxwell, can you clarify on that?
It'll be a direct democracy, but you can sort of delegate your votes to different people. So if you want to sort of hire someone to be your vote for you on Beacon Hill, you could give your vote to that person, and that way...
Oh, you mean for representatives to be able to vote by proxy?
Right.
Okay, that's like, I mean, so you're just saying that now you're talking about making it easier for actual elected officials to actually vote in the chamber.
No, I think so. We can move on. My sense of this is that he's saying actually everybody gets votes on every issue, and then they just hand those votes over to representatives. Like every bill that comes up, every person gets a vote.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I said.
I think the answer is no.
No, no is the answer.
Aaron's answered that. All right.
Just because. Our biggest problem is getting people to vote. I mean, I love the caller because the caller obviously has a lot of policy interest and could do this, but it would require so much attention from mass publics that maybe it could work in a smaller town or something like that. But I don't think you could scale that up.
So I wanted to get back just for a second to what Aaron was talking about in terms of how different approaches sometimes increase turnout but don't reduce disparities in voting across class lines. Should that be a fundamental interest in any voting reform? And what is the best approach to that if we want to sort of equalize access across class lines?
Liz Rigby, and she's at George Washington, she's done this empirical work. But if you can get one magic bullet reform, say you can only get one, and you want to lessen socioeconomic bias and turnout, same-day registration. That's the single best reform. But to your question, I think it's political. Me personally, Aaron O'Brien, does think that if we mitigate class bias, we know that when participation is more equal amongst low- and high-income people, social welfare policy is better, there's more expanded social services, and there's more investment in infrastructure. But there are others, not named Aaron O'Brien, who argue, listen, if you get to the polls, it's your job to get there or not. Class bias is a reflection of lack of interest.
Mitigating class bias is a perfectly reasonable choice.
It's a political question.
Right. In other words, if that's something you believe ought to be done, then you can advocate for it in the political arena, which includes advocating for changing the way we run elections.
All right, we've got another call. Aaron from North Andover has a theory for what's really wrong with voting. Aaron, are you there?
Yes. Hello, I'm here. I hear in the conversation about improving access to get voters to the polls, but nothing on, I guess, what you'd call the supply side, the supply of candidates. It's very hard for, say, minor parties to get ballot access and maintain it. I think that would improve a lot of voter interest if there were a broader variation of opinion on the candidate side.
All right, so maybe the problem isn't access to the polls, it's the candidates. You can think of this in a couple of ways. It could be that we're not getting the candidates we want, need, deserve, or it could be that people don't know enough about the candidates. Gerald, what do you think about the supply side
theory? The logic of what the caller's saying is perfect in the sense that, yes, there certainly are voters who would like more choices. I'm not so sure that the average voter necessarily, when push comes to shove, is going to use the increased choices in the way that the caller imagines they would use them. In other words, it makes perfect sense to say that if we only have a couple of people and we only have chocolate and vanilla, but I'm a real fan of strawberry, I should have a chance to choose strawberry. That's all very logical. But one of the points of representative democracy is to create institutional intermediaries between the voters and governing. And elections, obviously, are conducted so that so institutions can provide sort of a vetting process and a rationalizing process to translate the raw will of the people into some rational alternatives. And so whenever you start to talk about reforms to expand the opportunities to run for office, that's fine, as long as you understand that the average voter doesn't actually put a great deal of intellectual effort into studying candidates and issues.
Aaron?
Well, but it is a bit of a chicken and egg question, right? In the American system, Democrats and Republicans control the game. And if you're not into Democrats or Republicans that much, it's rational to tune them out. And so something like ranked choice does make it easier for candidates to break in, candidates that don't have the party backing or would rather run as a Green or some other party.
Well, so, guys, it has been a pleasure to talk to you and listen to you argue. That's the whole point of this. Aaron O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston, and Gerald Duquette, Associate Professor of Political Science at Central Connecticut State University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive director is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.